The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
I don't know how long it's going to take, but I think that we're walking through a fire, and hopefully it's a refiner's fire, and we'll get through it, and we'll be stronger for having gone through it. But, you know, I believe in this country, and I believe that in this people, and I think we're walking through a fire right now, but we're going to go. It's going to end, and we're going to get through it. That's what I think.
That's the opinion of Israeli journalist Carolyn Glick, or at least she hopes that's the case. Ms. Glick just sat down with us for a full hour here in Jerusalem, Israel. And so this Trumpet Daily program that Mr. Stephen Flurry has allowed me to guest host, for that we are going to listen to this interview with Ms. Glick. It's a very interesting interview, mainly covering Israel's relationship with the United States, or more importantly, Israel's the relationship the United States has had with Israel through the years of Barack Hussein Obama. If you're interested in the state of Israel and the Jewish state and what's going on here, Ms. Glick is certainly somebody that is worthwhile to listen to. So it's with our pleasure to play this interview for you for today's Trumpet Daily. Welcome, Carolyn, to the Trumpet Daily.
Oh, it's great to be on your program. Thanks for having me, Brent.
No worries. Pleased to have you. At the Trumpet, you're actually someone that we've been watching and reading for, I would say, about 20 years. Okay. You're one of the commentators that we value your insights, probably more than most, particularly, I think, as time goes on, because of your history in the United States and your history in Israel together, you're able to put those two things together in that relationship. So today, on this interview, I want to focus on the United States' relationship with Israel. Okay. And in particular, go through a little bit of history, particularly starting in 2008.
Gee, what happened then?
Yeah, what happened then? And then we'll get to today and see if there's a lasting impact of Barack Obama becoming the president of the United States. So he obviously said that one of his goals was, just before he got elected, that he was wanting to fundamentally transform the United States of America. And with that, obviously comes a transformation with America's relationship with its greatest ally in the Middle East, Israel. Mm-hmm. Can we speak, first of all, about his first term in government? If you can remember, you had the Cairo speech. You were one of the people early on, even during the first term, to recognize there was something wrong.
Yeah, actually, even during the election. Because I grew up in Hyde Park, the neighborhood on the south side of Chicago by University of Chicago that Barack Obama moved to in 1987. Hmm. And a lot of the people that were surrounding him when he launched his political career were people who we knew growing up from the neighborhood as communists.
Right.
And I remember I had a conversation with Senator in November after he was elected in 2008. And I said to him, you know, Hyde Park, the neighborhood, it really has only two export crops. The first one is Nobel laureates in economics from the University of Chicago Economics Department. And the other one is communists. And mm-hmm. I didn't hear anybody say anything about Obama getting a Nobel Prize for economics. So, I mean, it was, and then he used that in a speech that he subsequently gave, you know, but it was... It was very clear from the gang that he was with in Hyde Park that he was a very, very radical person.
So you probably did what most of the media didn't do in vetting Barack Obama before he came into office. Now, once he gets into office, I mean, what is his focus towards Israel? How do you see the traditional relationship with the United States and Israel? There's been some rocky patches, but still, the population of the United States is so pro-Israel, as in terms of general population, that it's always a winning platform to be pro-Israel.
Right. I mean, it's funny because AIPAC really made its bread and butter getting people to sign on to U.S. military assistance to Israel. And I've written against the aid and think we should give it up. But without connection, I always found that to be a strange calling card because it's really a free vote, or was, at least until 2000 and until Obama seized control over the Democratic Party and fundamentally first transformed that party, and then through that party he is transforming the United States. But he, but it was always, it was a default position was to stand with Israel, not only on military aid, but on everything, because the American population is just instinctively pro-Israel, so it was an easy vote to make. But Obama, I mean, he looks at the United States very differently from any president that preceded him, and it's because of that sort of, not sort of, very much anti-colonialist perspective on the United States, that the United States, which was never an imperialist power, I mean, it had a period, a very brief period at the end of the 19th century where it engaged in behavior that could be perceived as imperialist in places like Cuba and the Philippines, but was still far different from the European powers or from the Islamic powers or whatever. People who perceive the United States as a colonialist, imperialist power do so because they were schooled in a Soviet indoctrination program, basically, that went through the American left, that had told a lot of members of the American elite, particularly in university campuses, but not only, that everything that the Soviet Union essentially was doing in terms of building empires and subjugating the peoples therein, that was actually American behavior. And so it was a caustically anti-American perception, and the PLO, which was in some sense created by the KGB and certainly enabled by the KGB, embraced that philosophy of decolonialism or anti-colonialism when they tried to, and unfortunately it's becoming more successful today than ever before, of attributing to Israel everything that Israel isn't, and to Zionism everything that nobody ever thought of could possibly be related to Zionism, which is that we're an imperialist movement, a colonialist movement. There's no indigenous Judaism or Jewish roots in the Promised Land, and that the real Jews are the Palestinians. So it's both erasing Jewish history, inventing a false history of the Jews, and then appropriating actual Jewish history to the Palestinians. So that is very attractive to Americans and other Westerners that are schooled in this kind of Soviet anti-Americanism, anti-colonialist mindset. And that's who Barack Obama is, and that's who all the people who were around him in Hyde Park are and always have been.
So you wrote about this actually in 2012 and what in his support for the Palestinians in this, you're seeing the Israelis as the, you know, colonialist power, and then you've got the freedom fighters would be the Palestinians trying to, you know, shake off, you know, the colonialist power. This is what you write. This is an article, Chuck Hagel for Defense Secretary, Bring It On. Nice title. This is from December 16, 2012. This is what you could see with this appointment to Defense Secretary. You said Obama wants to hurt Israel. He does not like Israel. He is appointing anti-Israel advisors and cabinet members not despite their anti-Israel positions, but because of them. And then you write towards the end, moreover, one of his strongest advantages is that Israel's supporters seem to have never gotten the memo. So here it is, the memo. Obama wants to fundamentally transform the United States with Israel. And you're saying, you know, he has kind of done that, even citing in the first term.
Well, in the first term, I mean, I think you signed at the outset in June 2009, this was, I think, his first trip abroad. He went to Egypt, and he spoke at the University of Cairo. And he did a number of things at that speech, and he said a number of things at that speech that showed to anybody willing to look just how incredibly hostile Obama was in his outlook towards Israel, towards Jews, and towards the United States of America. And so One of the things that he did, first of all, in the audience of the speech right. itself, he invited members of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood is the core of the jihadist movement in the Sunni Arab world. That it's like the kernel of all of the terrorist organizations, from Hamas, which is a Muslim Brother organization, or to Al-Qaeda, to ISIS, to the terrorist organizations in Pakistan and Egypt, the Egyptian Jihad that killed Sadat, and so many more. I mean, it spawned dozens of terrorist organizations. It's also very tightly aligned with the Shiite jihadists in the Iranian regime. They work in coordination with Hezbollah. We saw it in the war in Iraq, and so they were the enemies of the Mubarak regime.
He was the strong U.S. ally
for 30 years.
Right.
He was the anchor of the American alliance system in the Sunni Arab world, and Mubarak had outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood already when he took over from Sadat, because it was Muslim Brotherhood operatives who assassinated Anwar right. Sadat in 1981. So they were outlawed, and Obama invited members of the Muslim Brotherhood to sit in the audience in the front
right.
at his interview. So Mubarak was so angry about that, he didn't even meet Obama at the airport when he arrived. And so that was just in the setting, right, of the speech itself, before it even began.
Right.
And then in the speech itself, he gave a revised history, both of American policy and of Jewish history and of the history of the Arab conflict with Israel and, of course, the Palestinians. And he did in that speech everything that the PLO has been doing from the time that Arafat founded Fatah, its core organization, right. in 1958, which is to appropriate Jewish history for the Arabs, blot out Jewish history for the Jews, and treat the Arabs like they were the actual Jews. So he did all of those things in that speech, and he blamed America and the Jews
right.
for all of the pathologies of the Islamic world. And remember, this was before the Arab Spring,
right.
but it was an instigator of
the
Arab Spring. Yes. And so that was what Obama did. And so just in realm of Jewish history, so he said about the Jews that we needed a state because we were persecuted in Europe.
Right.
And so what? So then we should move to Canada or
right,
America
right,
or
right, right.
wherever. But why would we move to Israel?
Right.
Well, there was no mention of why we would move to Israel. It was supposed to be a refuge, like a refugee camp for Jews. Like, why would we go there?
Right.
And then he refused to visit Israel from Cairo, which is a usual move by an American president on his first Middle Eastern trip. He goes, if he goes to an Arab country, then he comes
to Trump
Israel.
Trump went to Saudi Arabia and then
And then
to
he
Israel.
Came to Jerusalem. Obama went from Saudi Arabia to Dachau. So, like, he was saying the Jews' history began in 1939 with Hitler's rise.
Right.
You know, there's nothing to hear, you know, to see right. here in the land of Israel. And he didn't come. He went to a death camp. I mean, that is the PLO narrative. That is the made-up idea that Jews are colonialists.
Mm-hmm.
Right there in the mouth of an American president, he said that our history began with the rise of Hitler, essentially, that the land of Israel belonged to the Palestinians, that America had to apologize for its sins, for its crimes against the Muslim world. He apologized for the overthrow of Mousazadeh in Iran in the 1950s, even though he richly deserved to be overthrown, and he was overthrown by the Iranians. But so he was embracing all of these Soviet agitprop lies about the CIA, about the Americans, and about the Jews. And that was his first major speech. So, and it only went downhill from there, you know. That was a declaration of intentions. And then from there we got the policy.
Right. One other thing he mentioned there, if my memory serves, is that he said that no country has the right to determine, you know, who has nuclear, I don't know if he said nuclear weapons or not, but he opened the door to what was, he had already obviously started to think about and was working behind the scenes soon enough with Hillary Clinton, with the Iranian regime, at opening the door to some type of
nuclear
agreement.
Well, he actually said it at a presidential debate with Clinton and John Edwards, where he said they asked, they were asked by the moderator if they would meet with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was Iran's president, and he openly called repeatedly for Israel's annihilation and for it to be wiped off the map and all the rest of it. And he was the only one who said yes. So that was already clear, you know. I mean, it's not that I trust it's Hillary Clinton to do something worthwhile, but, I mean, he just said it. You're like, right there. It was still in 2007.
Right. So, well, if we can jump to the, from Cairo, obviously, you know, Muslim Brotherhood, Arab Spring rattled through everywhere. The areas that the United States endorsed, the toppling of a ruler, they lost. You know, Mubarak's gone. Assad stays, you know, different
Muslim
places.
Muslim Brotherhood's
in power. Mohammed Morsi comes in until he's overthrown to kind of put the brakes on things, you know, from the current leader of Egypt. The nuclear deal was a big thing, a big foreign policy change for Obama because obviously the deal itself, we don't need to rehash all the deal, the things of the deal. But starting in 2012, all the way through to 2015, and it was initiated in the start of 2016, this nuclear deal, what was that about fundamentally? Was it about Iran getting access to a nuclear weapon? Was it about embracing Iran, trying to bring it into the community of nations? Was it about balancing out the neighborhood, as he said in that interview, I think, with Jonah Goldberg at the time? Was it about weakening the state of Israel? The nuclear deal, you wrote in 2013 that he could have signed it in 2012, but in 2013 you wrote that, well, this process as it goes on and it's negotiating, you saw that it weakened Israel through this negotiating process.
It's true. So first of all, just very briefly, the purpose of the nuclear deal is not to block Iran's path to the bomb, it's to enable Iran to become a nuclear armed state. And it's very clear because it had, you know, it was all sunsetted out, all of the restrictions on Iran's nuclear operations, so that even in the, under the unlikely scenario that that in fact didn't happen, would that Iran would keep the deal, they would still have a nuclear bomb by at latest 2030. So there was never any doubt that this was not nuclear non-proliferation. This was nuclear proliferation. It was enabling Iran, the largest state sponsor of terror, a country that has been at war with the United States since the revolution in 1979, that they would become a nuclear armed state. And so, first of all, it wasn't non-proliferation, it was proliferation, and that's very important. It still is, because that's Biden's policy as well. But the other aspect of it that was very important along the lines of the speech in Cairo was its purpose was to realign America's Middle East positioning away from Israel at Israel's expense, away from the Sunni Arabs at their expense, and towards Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood. And so this was also just about repositioning the United States. And this also was induced or informed by this anti-American worldview that Obama and his close advisors all embrace, that the United States is what's wrong in the world, its allies, anybody who likes the old America is equally evil and equally culpable for the crimes and sins of the United States of America, because they must be, because they like America. And aside from all the demonology and demonization that he did to Israel specifically in that line. And now, in regards to the question of the attrition of Israel over time, is that, you know, if he had signed that deal, which was essentially just a surrender to Iran's nuclear ambitions and an empowering of Iran, which is his goal, it wouldn't have passed, because what he had to do was prepare the ground domestically for the radical transformation of American foreign policy. So that, I mean, things like bringing on Hagel and his first Secretary of Defense was Bush's, Robert Gates was also a Republican. So what they had in common was a common dislike for Israel, a common embrace of a narrative that said that Israel is the problem in the Middle East, and that it's a burden to the United States as opposed to an asset And by bringing in key figures in the Republican Party into his cabinet, and then also neutralizing them, you know, not letting them do any of the sort of milquetoast Republican policymaking that these very moderate Republicans, who are sort of the James Baker Republicans, embraced, that was very anti-Israel. Aside from being anti-Israel together, you know, he didn't really let them do a lot. Mm-hmm. And yet, by doing that, he neutralized a large chunk of the Republicans. And so, for instance, when he wanted to pass through the Iran nuclear deal, by all accounts, it has to be considered a treaty.
Right.
And it wasn't a treaty because he was able to co-opt the moderate Republicans. And so the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, we're going back historically.
It's okay.
Suddenly I can't remember his name. He passed this law, which was insane, which stood the U.S. Constitution on its head,
right,
that said, you know, you only need a third to vote. You need two-thirds to vote against it in order for it not to pass. So, which means you only needed a third plus one to pass. And that's really what he had. He had the support of 40 senators.
Right.
And with just that support, he was able to completely destroy 50 or 70 years of American nonproliferation work. Henry Kissinger and George Shultz wrote an article about it in the Wall Street Journal at the time. He said this destroys, utterly and completely destroys, 70 years of American nonproliferation diplomacy.
So at that time, you know, the big elephant in the room, or the elephant in Congress, was Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yes. Elephant isn't Republican, but no, he wasn't Republican. He was
right.
Israeli.
He was
right.
Israeli, and he's invited by the speaker to come and speak. And this is right before the nuclear deal would eventually be, if it was ever signed, agreed upon. And Barack Obama took great... He was very upset about this, that Benjamin Netanyahu would come and speak to the House and say and declare that this deal is horrible, it does not benefit Israel, you need to wake up for what's going on. You wrote a column saying, column one, Netanyahu's true electoral rival, and you were talking about how that speech really did set off Barack Obama to go after the man, Benjamin Netanyahu, that he saw Benjamin Netanyahu as perhaps a lone figure of that would try and put a stop to this nuclear deal at any means possible.
It's true. Although he had been pretty horrible to Netanyahu,
right,
previously, but what happened in 2015 is that when Netanyahu went to the joint houses, and people, you know, now they're sort of criticizing him, saying, why aren't you doing it today, you know, shouldn't you be going to Washington and rallying the Republicans? But that ignores just how much has been transformed in the United States. Because by 2015, although Barack Obama had captivated completely the Democratic Party, I mean, it had become his party after his reelection in 2012,
right,
there were still sort of more traditional Democrats in the Senate, in particular, because the rollover is slower, who were dependable friends of Israel, who were less beholden to Obama. So they weren't great, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like
Menendez
was opposed to it, and he was good until he got indicted,
right,
and then he kind of went silent. But he was good, and Schumer voted against the deal, even though he wouldn't speak out against the deal, and he was sort of lame on that, and most of them were, and so was Ben Cardin in Maryland. You know, these are Jews, and they're very pro-Israel, but they were cowed. They were cowed into submission or being quiet, although they did vote against the deal, which was important. But in 2023, the Democratic Party today is so radical, it's so woke, it's so captivated by the Obama continuation of by Obama's legacy of his people who have really seated themselves in positions that are decisive in the party, it would probably arguably have done more harm than good. But by being there in 2015, Netanyahu was able to both get those Democrats who would have voted for the agreement to oppose it, but I think from much more importantly, he galvanized Republicans, because Republicans opposed the deal, but there wasn't a clear understanding of just how devastating it was until Netanyahu came. And so mm-hmm. then you saw this incredible thing in 2016, 2015 in the Republican primaries,
right.
that I think there were 17 candidates, and every single one of them pledged to withdraw from the nuclear deal if elected president. And that I attribute to Netanyahu. I think that probably a lot of them, and Ted Cruz for sure, and many, you know, some others who really, really pro-Israel in that group. But the fact of its unanimity was, I'm absolutely certain it was because Netanyahu alerted the American people of the dangers of Obama's policy, and just legitimizing the controversy over it was incredibly important.
I want to stick with this relationship with Netanyahu and Obama, though, because I do think there's something a little bit more to it. 2015 was a critical year for Netanyahu's re-election. The State Department of the United States, State Department was proven to have meddled in that mm-hmm. election by the sponsorship of certain groups that were out to get out the vote, get out the Arab vote, it seemed, with some grants, things like that. We had a brief reprieve with President Trump in power, and which has done a lot, obviously, for the Israel-American relationship. We'll get to that in a second. But take me to 2015. You were watching this in real time. People were talking about Netanyahu saying, you know, he's calling out the Arabs for driving in buses, getting driven in buses, and he's a racist and things like that. You probably remember that. Do you see that? You know, the Obama administration's disdain for Netanyahu as just being something that's a policy that Netanyahu has, that he does not, he's going to protect the United States of Israel regardless, and he's going to push back at the nuclear deal and try and blow this thing up as much as he can. That was for the nuclear deal, but is this something that has continued from 2015 onwards? Do you still see this undercurrent in now the Biden administration against Netanyahu and his leadership of Israel?
No, you hit on something that I think is very fundamental, is that, you know, and I know you wanted to end with the left's insurrection here in Israel against the Netanyahu government and what they're doing in the streets of Israel today, but it began with Obama. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was an American project. This was...
What was?
To demonize Netanyahu and destroy him. And the enmity, the ferocity of the hatred against Netanyahu, because Netanyahu is viewed, and it's really kind of ironic. You know, I said that these radical progressives like Obama and his people are schooled in this Soviet conceptualization mm-hmm. of the United States as an imperialist root of all evil kind of power. But what's interesting about Soviet demonology is that in the Soviet planetary orbit of evil, Jews are right up there with the Americans, mm-hmm. and so and the way, and it's a sort of this Jewish conspiracy theory of Jewish power and Jewish control over markets, over brains, you know, over souls, over whatever, like everything that people have, and over the United States, that it was a constant threat of Soviet propaganda. Mm-hmm. And if you read the Matrokin archives from the KGB about the Third World, it's very clear that Israel was the main target of Soviet disinformation and propaganda and demonology, because they viewed Israel as the number one threat. And the idea of that, I think, informs very much the thinking also of progressives and the way that they view Israel. And Netanyahu, who stood up to the Americans like Daniel in the lion's den before the joint houses of Congress and explained the dangers, and he did it in a masterful way, because he was very, on the surface, flattering towards Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, upholding him as a pro-Israel president while he ripped to shreds the rationality of his, the centerpiece of his foreign policy, which is appeasing Iran through nuclear armament, and showed just how insane that was. And so Netanyahu was masterful because he rose above the personal enmity in his statements in that speech, which was extraordinary. And Obama, on the other hand, tried to reduce everything that he said to Netanyahu's personality, and then he wanted, and he understood that Netanyahu is his gravest threat in the international arena, not Ahmadinejad, not Ayatollah Khamenei, not anybody. Obama views Netanyahu as his number one enemy. And then you'll see that American funding and American facilitation.
Because
he defends Israel against
right.
it. Mm-hmm. It's not even that he exposes so much that he's defending Israel against this. And mm-hmm. he's standing up to it and saying, this is not true.
Right.
You can't operate this way. It's a grave danger to America, not just to
right.
Israel. We'll stand, he said. We'll stand with our friends, but even without our friends, we'll stand. That's
right.
what he said. So he said, we don't need you. We're going to do this. And so you see that a centerpiece of Obama's the remaining months of Obama's presidency, or the final year of Obama's presidency, and then going forward with the radicalization of the Democratic Party under Trump, and now under Biden, you see that the war against Israel has been focused specifically in the personage of Netanyahu and demonizing him and everybody who comes into contact with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a legacy of Obama's infuriation, of his blind rage at Netanyahu's speech before the joint houses.
You wrote an article in the Jerusalem Post. It's entitled "Obama's Mysterious Visit." This is just after he came into office a second time,
mm-hmm.
and this time he does travel to mm-hmm. Israel, and it was very confusing as to what he is doing coming here. And you said there was one element of his trip to Israel that was revealing. This is what you wrote. First of all, you talk about how he snubbed Ariel University up in Samaria. He's not going to visit, and so
no, he didn't invite students from the university to.
He didn't invite students
to sit in the audience of an auditorium where he had students from all universities.
Right. So you contrast this to, you know, a Muslim Brotherhood coming mm-hmm. to get the speech in Cairo. They're invited, but obviously Ariel University is not going to be invited
right.
to this one. Then you say this: the only revealing aspect of Obama's itinerary is his decision to, on the one hand, bypass Israel's elective representatives by spurning the invitation to speak before the Knesset, and on the other hand, to address a hand-picked audience of university students, an audience grossly overpopulated by unelectable radical leftists. In the past, U.S. presidents have spoken before audiences of Israeli leftists in order to elevate and empower the political left against the right. But this is the first time that a U.S. president has spurned not only the elected right, but the elected leftist politicians as well, by failing to speak to the Knesset while actively courting the unelectable radical left through his talk to a university audience. I don't want to be like, you know, conspiratorial too much, but this is 2013, and nowadays we read this and we're like, wow, I mean, this is something that has played out over the past 10 years or so.
Yeah, you're reading it to me and I'm like, wow, I was right.
You were right. This was what happened. He bypassed the Knesset and he went straight to these unelectable, on the left, intellectual class of people, and spoke directly to them. Was Barack Obama, the community organizer, doing that in Israel?
He's organizing. He's organizing the resistance in Israel. You know, I remember when Trump was inaugurated, and we started hearing all of these new terms, right, in America that we had never heard before. Resistance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is resistance in America? You resist a tyranny. You resist, you know, like this is what you hear in a non-democratic state. You resist an oppressor. But what you have is is a president who was just elected constitutionally in the United States.
You have a means to.
Yeah, and if you don't like him, then, you know, take over the majority of both houses of Congress in 2 years and take back the White House in four. Right. You know, that's how things always go. American politics are a pendulum,
right,
as they are in all democracies, or republics, or whatever, you know, popularly elected by rules that everybody agrees to,
right,
government. And here you had Democrats who were rejecting the legitimacy of Trump's election, of the process, of the votes.
Right.
And I remember hearing all of this resistance talk in the United States. And then, lo and behold, in 2022, November 1st, Netanyahu and the religious right bloc were reelected with a commanding 64-seat majority in the Knesset, which has 120 seats. And why that sounds, well, it's only 64 out of, well, no, because you have to understand, we were in deadlock for over 2 years.
Four elections.
Right, four elections with, you know, with a 60, and, you know, the most that the Likud ever, and the right bloc ever got was 60, and then it kept going down, and then whatever. So we get an actual majority after four deadlocked elections. That's huge.
Right.
And immediately, like that night, the night of the elections, when the polls closed and the exit polls were counted and then the actual numbers were revealed in Israel, we still do it the next day, which is
right,
apparently weird for Americans to hear. But we got the actual results and he won. And immediately they started saying it was illegitimate. And immediately, I mean, Yair Lapid was still interim prime minister. He went out and started protesting against the government that hadn't even been sworn in as prime minister. It was incredible. You had Gadi Eisenkot, who's a member of Knesset from one of the parties on the left, former chief of staff of the IDF, calling for a million people to go into the streets to resist a government that hadn't been formed yet.
Mm-hmm.
And calling, you know, there, you had voices calling for civil war. And they like to pretend it's about, you know, judicial reform constraining our court that has no limits on its power anymore. But there was no judicial reform when they were making these calls.
Right,
nothing
right,
was on the
right.
agenda because there was no government.
Right. So that's what, you know, just outside here every Saturday night, everyone's protesting, making a big noise by the president's house. It continues to this day. And I want to talk about this a little bit. I do want to come up. I praised you so much that we're going to have to find something to see if you disagree with something that you wrote.
Okay.
From this same article. Because again, you contrast what was happening with Obama here speaking here, and you thought it wouldn't work. You thought it wouldn't work.
Here in Israel.
Here in Israel, as it worked in Cairo. You wrote this, it is possible that in addressing the unelected radical left in Jerusalem, Obama seeks to undermine the legitimacy of the Israeli government. But if that's the plan, then it would bespeak an extraordinary contempt and underestimation of Israeli democracy. Such a plan would not play out the same way his Egyptian speech did. Now, of course, there's more to it. There's more nuance to it than that. And Israeli democracy did produce a very clear outcome in the past election.
And also in 2015. I mean, this was before the 2015 election.
Right. However, there's still people protesting on the streets.
Not
that
just
continues.
It's getting worse and worse. They're becoming more and more radicalized with every passing day. I mean, they just busted up Yom Kippur services in pogroms in Tel Aviv and in other cities in central Israel. And, you know, if those actions have been taken in any other country in the world, you would have had Jews, not just Israel, but Jews all around the world and friends of Jews all around the world jumping up and down and screaming about this anti-Semitism can't stand. Jews cannot be abused in prayer, and yet it happened here because the left in Israel has become so radicalized that they've been so incited against their brothers and sisters in Israel that when they look at Jews in prayer on the holiest night of the Jewish calendar, on the evening of Yom Kippur, at the end of Yom Kippur, the following evening, it's not clear who they're looking at, like what they see anymore, but they don't see brothers. And this is something that you know, we never imagined could happen. Or we had people go to America last week to when Netanyahu was there to protest him, but they weren't protesting him. They were accusing Israel of war crimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were saying that our democracy is illegitimate. They were saying that our elections are illegitimate. And don't believe the prime minister. They put it on a billboard that they projected onto the UN building. The UN is, aside from the Iranian regime, the most powerful and dangerous anti-Semitic institution in the world. I mean, they propagate anti-Semitic libels every day, and they fund some of the worst organizations in terms of demonizing the Jewish people and waging war against Israel. And yet here are these Israelis projecting this image, saying that, you know, don't believe the crime minister. Mm-hmm. So all of this stuff is unprecedented. And I certainly would, if you had told me in 2013 that this could happen, I'm wondering whether I would believe you. Mm-hmm. It's possible if you had a crystal ball and you were able to show me that how criminal indictments were going to be hatched against Netanyahu, where they were going to invent crimes and right. then say that Netanyahu committed them, and then demonize him as a criminal. If you went through and you told me, look, Carolyn, and you don't see this in 2013, but let me tell you what's going to happen in 2018 and 19 and 20 and 20, like, I guess I would believe you, but it just as it was inconceivable just a month ago that anybody would try to block Jews from praying in Yom Kippur, go to the UN and demonize Israel in the name of Israel, it would have been hard to believe. I might have thought that you were a crackpot. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's so beyond our experience, what we're experiencing.
And it's happened so fast as well.
It's cascaded, but it's been building for quite some time.
So just to bring in Trump now, because I think an American audience, they see what's happened to Trump and they can just, they have in their minds, you know, that what she took, this sounds indicted, you know.
Trumped up charges.
They tried it in Israel. The purpose of it was to get him not to run, mm-hmm. to find a way of
pushing
Netanyahu off the ticket. Mm-hmm. And now we see it happening in the United States. Do you feel like the United States, what position are they in comparison to Israel with this?
Sometimes I think that America is in front of us. Sometimes I think we're in front of America. Mm-hmm. But I think that the same forces in the United States at work are at work here.
So what are those forces? Do they have a face? Do they have a thrust? Or not a thrust? Is it organized? And we've only got another probably 5 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. And you have a second glass of water.
I have a second glass of water, so now I can do that 5 minutes without.
Because you say that this is the same forces at play. What are those forces, in your opinion?
It's our elites, as broadly defined as people. My friend Gadi Taub brought a book in Hebrew called "Movables and Immovables," and basically, it was the idea that our societies are being split between people whose lives take place where they are. Mm-hmm. If you're from Oklahoma, then the center of your life is your community, is your town, and you're very rooted in that. Your monetary interests are local or national. They're inside of your country. And then the movables are like the globalists who don't view their primary ties to being the people who live next door to them. They may not know their neighbors, they may not care who their neighbors are. They don't feel a sense of belonging inside of their nation, which they consider to be provincial. And in Israel's case, people who ascribe to this worldview view Israel as a backwater and something to be embarrassed about, and they want to be part of a global elite. And I view it differently from him. I understand where he's coming from, and I think that there's a lot of that to it. I think that there is a bifurcation, and you see it very clearly in the United States, between globalists and nationalists.
Right.
My view is that in the case of the Jewish state, mm-hmm. it's people who embrace our Jewish identity, people who identify ourselves first and foremost as Jews, and second of all is Israelis, and people who thought that the purpose of Israel was to solve the Jewish problem of, you know, European Jews that were neither here nor there, and they thought that it would somehow or another end the hatred of the Jewish people, that once we got here and, you know, as David Ben-Gurion used to talk about, we would have Jewish criminals and Jewish prostitutes and Jew, like all the things that you have in Russian society or British society or Polish society or whatever, or German society, we would have them here too. And then everybody would look at the Jews as just normal people, mm-hmm. and they would stop hating us. And so there was this very utopian concept that being a Jew was sort of a problem that had to be solved, as opposed to an identity that we love. Mm-hmm. And when that problem that they, as they saw it, the Jewish problem wasn't solved, that the hatred of Jews as individuals was transposed into the hatred of Jews as the collective in Israel, and that that Jew hatred moved from race-based to nationalism-based because our base of operations became our nation state, right. So that it just followed us here and changed its face a little bit, then they became disaffected with a Jewish state because it didn't fulfill the promise that they thought that it was going to hold for them. And then they've turned on their Judaism, that the Judaism is the problem, and it's self-hatred. And on the other hand, the majority of Jews who are happy to be Jews and who just thought that Israel was a place where we could be Jews in the fullest extent without persecution and with, you know, not having to ask for permission from anybody, right. and view sovereignty as the way for us to fulfill our lives as Jews in our land, we're bothersome to them because we like being Jews, because we like being a Jewish state, because we like the national language to be Hebrew, we like the national faith to be Judaism, and our institutions to follow the Jewish calendar, and we guide our lives by that, not by the Gregorian calendar and other people's holidays and other people's ideals. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think it's more specifically Jewish, but I think that Gadi is right, that it's also just part of the split that you're seeing in America, that you see in Europe, between people whose center of life and their loyalties are to their nation and their national destiny, versus people who reject nationalism and embrace globalist attitudes, which is very condescending and sometimes condemnatory towards the people that they live amongst.
So we're not in the best spot here in Israel right now. I mean, this is something that you are very vocal about. People, if they follow you, you're outspoken a few times a week. You've got your own podcast as well.
The Carolyn Glick Show.
Carolyn Glick Show. It's found on YouTube, Rumble as well. I saw it there. You also have your website, carolynglick.com. You put everything that you do up there for years. This is how I can find all the research on you. Get the dirt.
Back from 2002 when I started writing for the Jerusalem Post,
And right now you're the senior contributing editor for the Jewish News Syndicate.
That's right, janus.org.
And so if people want to follow you, they can go to those separate platforms?
I go back and forth because I'm also affected by what's happening. So when mm-hmm. I see Jews being bullied and prevented from praying on Yom Kippur, you know, my husband was beside himself, and I was too, but I was more angry and thinking about what I would write about it than,
right.
but people are truly like in distress over
right.
what happened on Yom Kippur. This is because if you have a sense of the holy, the concept of blocking people from praying on Yom Kippur or showing up with beer at the prayers.
Yeah, it's Antiochus Epiphanes type of thing.
It's so horrific that it's unspeakable, and yet it happened. So when you look at things like that, what's going to happen? What is God doing to us? What are we missing here? And are we making a mistake? How are we making a mistake? And you try to examine that, but then, if you believe, if you understand that truth matters, mm-hmm. and if you understand that the direction that we've taken as a people, and that was shown in the November 1st elections, and in various, and that the government is continuing to operate, maybe not as well as I'd like it to, not as competently as I would like it to, but they're not falling apart, they're staying together, they're staying the course, and the people are staying the course, and yeah, the polls are this, the polls are that, who knows what the polls are, but by and large, people aren't losing their heads in among the majority of Israelis. Mm-hmm. And then you see a lot of the people who have been, who have bought into the demonization, saying, but we didn't sign up for abusing Jews in prayer on Yom Kippur.
It's gone so far that it might...
That the pendulum... Again, we are a democracy, and we're a democratic people, and we don't hate one another, and we have much more in common than that separates us, although some pretty existential things do separate us. It's true, but I don't think that the majority... I know that the majority of Israelis don't want to live anywhere else, do want to live in the Jewish state, do view themselves as Jewish first and foremost, and revel in that identity. They don't hate it. And so I think that... I don't know how long it's going to take, but I think that we're walking through a fire, and hopefully it's a refiner's fire, and we'll get through it, and we'll be stronger for having gone through it. But, you know, I believe in this country, and I believe that in this people, and I think we're walking through a fire right now, but we're going to go, it's going to end, and we're going to get through it. That's what I think.
Well, thank you.
Thank you
very much for your honest time and your honest opinions. We appreciate it very much.
And thanks for doing the archaeology, the archaeological excavation of my work. It's good to see that at least on some of the things I was pretty right.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.